the generosity so many donations have poured in to help people restart their lives, but you know, this is still a tough moment, a lot of grieving.
I understand there was also a lot of concern among residents in the community about people's pets that were left behind in those apartments. What happened to the animals?
Yeah, sadly, we haven't heard of animals being rescued, but Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine Cava spoke about this last night. She said rescue teams did work hard to make sure there were no pets still in there. And officials said they just had to move forward with last night's demolition because of Tropical Storm Elsa, which is expected to move into the area, or at least could bring high winds and rain to this part of South Florida later today.
So what happens next?
Well, a lot of that will depend on the storm and what weather comes here. The crews will keep working in rotating shifts as long as it's safe, looking for victims and recovering bodies. It's slow and painstaking and risky. Forensic teams are also working to identify those who have been found. Meanwhile, of course, there are investigations underway to find out how this devastating condo collapse could have happened.
NPR's Brian Mann in Miami Beach. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
What does all this mean for the search efforts for those 121 people unaccounted for? Mayor of Surfside, Florida, Charles Burkett, is back with us. Good morning, Mayor Burkett.
Good morning.
So in Brian Mann's reporting just now, we heard Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz speak of further sadness and sorrow. What's your message to the residents whose homes are now lost following last night's controlled demolition?
I sat with Debbie, with those families, the other day, and we went through very difficult circumstances with them. We're going to do everything we can. First of all, we acknowledge that their lives have been completely torn apart. We acknowledge that they've lost their homes and all their possessions. And we acknowledged at that meeting that there's no worse disaster, probably, short of, you know, themselves being victims in that collapse that they could have experienced. So we're sensitive to that. Debbie has great connections with FEMA, and she's utilizing those connections, and we're doing everything we can for those families.
How were crews able to bring down the remaining part of this building with explosives without disturbing the existing debris pile and further burying potential victims?
Well, that was something that the governor and I talked about a couple days ago when the first discussion of taking the building down was had. The hurricane was coming. The potential for that building to fall on the pile with the victims in it was a tragic thought. The governor and I thought that it needed to be taken down immediately. We moved in that direction. We expressed that to the mayor. She had been told that it could not be done. The governor provided her information, as did our town, because we went right to work talking to those demolition companies. And to the mayor's great credit, in a sign of spectacular leadership, she made a 180-degree turn moved to take the building down immediately, which did several very good things. What it did was it opened up the debris pile, which was closed down. One-third of it was closed down to workers because that standing building was so dangerous that they couldn't get near it. Now the whole pile is available to them, and we will pour more resources onto that pile and get everybody out in that area also. Secondly, we couldn't guarantee that the building would fall in the right direction, which it did. The building, the explosives were designed to have the building fall away from the pile.
Okay.
And not impinge upon the search and rescue efforts that were taking place. So it needed to happen. It was a problem. We needed to make the problem go away, and that's exactly what happened.
President Biden had approved a disaster declaration for Florida due to Tropical Storm Elsa. How concerned are you about the storm that's on its way?
Well, as of last night, I was not overly concerned, because it seemed as though it had moved further to the west again. I haven't seen it this morning, but I will take a look. I do want to note that President Biden's staff has personally sent me a copy of that. They have been amazing, supportive, and early with respect to all of their help and all of their advice. And we are very, very grateful here in Florida and especially in Surfside for the president's intervention and the attention that he's given us.
It's been 12 days now since the collapse on June 24th. At this point, has the search and rescue efforts now shifted to a recovery effort?
Not at all. It's It's absolutely a 100% search and rescue effort. I have been, going around and educating people about, people who survive in collapse building situations. The BBC did a great piece on it a few years ago where they went around and looked at different locations and collapses and found that one lady in Bangladesh was pulled out of rubble 17 days after the collapse crying. So we're not anywhere near giving up. We're going to find people. We're going to pull everybody out of that rubble. We're going to get everybody out, and we're expecting miracles, and we're working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, until we get everybody out.
This particular building had many red flags. The 2018 engineering report that detailed structural problems, infighting on the condo board from documents obtained by NPR, and lawsuits. So taking the hard lessons of this disaster, what's going to change in terms of how your city handles inspections, permitting, and certification procedures moving forward?
Well, listen, it's not going to be our little town that's going to make changes. It's going to be the state of Florida. There are going to be significant changes based upon the findings. NIST is there. That's the national agency that oversees building collapses, not unlike the NTSB's airplane crashes. They will work. We will find out why this happened. There was something very, very wrong here at this property. And we need to get to the bottom of that.
Surfside Mayor Charles Burkett. Mayor, thank you.
Thank you.
One of the worst disasters in the history of the Philippines Air Force killed at least 50 people, including 47 military personnel and 3 civilians over the weekend. The plane was transporting troops within the islands, and authorities are now investigating what happened. Here's NPR's Julie McCarthy.
A video taken by Philippine soldiers awaiting the arrival of the C-130 shows the plane coming in for a landing at the airport on the small island of Jolo. Then the shock. Witnesses watch the plane overshoot the runway before it bursts into a fireball. Black plumes billow into a sunny, undisturbed sky. Witnesses said a number of soldiers were seen dropping from the aircraft before it hit the ground. Defense analyst Jose Custodio says the airport with its single airstrip is rudimentary and leaves little room to maneuver.
It's really a combination of so many things. Pilots seem to have made an error, tried to correct the error, but the physical limitations of the airport were unforgiving, and that's why you had this tragedy happening.
The plane was transporting troops, many of them fresh from basic training, to Sulu, a string of islands in the south that is predominantly Muslim. For decades there, government forces have battled secessionists and Islamist militants, including the small but extremely violent jihadist group Abu Sayyaf. The Philippines and the U.S. have branded the group an outlawed terrorist organization. The crashed C-130 was first flown in 1988 and arrived from the United States in January as part of a military assistance program. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan offered condolences to the Philippines and said the U.S. was ready to provide all appropriate support. The Philippines' small fleet of C-130s has been grounded pending an investigation. Julie McCarthy, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
19 past 8 now, and you're listening to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. President Biden and the White House have said they want to make a big push on voting rights now that legislation has failed. But how much can the administration really do without Congress? Stay tuned for that story. You can hear it in 15 minutes.
There are those who want more money, and there are those who obsess over wanting more money.
I'm not kidding. I'm always thinking about money. Like, when I say this, people think I'm joking.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, finding the balance. Next time on Marketplace.
Listen for Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo. The 10-acre site of new outdoor exhibits and birding trails, featuring all 15 of the world's crane species, is now open daily. SavingCranes.org.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, a new video from the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin featuring a past performance of Glenn Burley's inspirational Alpha Mass is on the group's YouTube channel. The concert was performed with the St. Paul Missionary Baptist Church.
Mostly sunny skies across Wisconsin today. There's a chance of afternoon thunderstorms for the northeastern, central, and southern parts of the state. Highs from the upper 80s to the low 90s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Tire Rack. For more than 40 years, Tire Rack has remained committed to helping people find the right tires, wheels, and automotive accessories. A tire decision guide is at tirerack.com/TDG. From iDrive, providing cloud backup, full system backup, and on-site iDrive appliance to protect PCs, Macs, and servers from data loss due to crashes and ransomware. At iDrive.com/NPR. And from the Jack Kent Cook Foundation, providing scholarships to exceptionally high-achieving students with financial need from middle school to college. More information about Cook scholarships is at jkcf.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Noelle King. Good morning. President Biden had a goal. 70% of Americans would have at least one COVID vaccine shot by July 4th. Now, that didn't happen, but it depends on where you look in the country. Some states have exceeded 70%. Other states aren't even close. Here's Martha Biebinger from WBUR in Boston.
Back in January, Massachusetts was trailing most of the country on vaccinations. So the state switched strategies. It started opening mass vaccination sites at a convention center, malls, and sports stadiums.
Welcome to the Gillette Stadium Vaccination Supersite.
In parking lots typically packed with New England Patriot fans, Jumbotron speakers blasted vaccination appointment instructions.
Please make sure you stay in your car until 15 minutes before your appointment.
As many as 8,000 residents a day snaked through lines to a waiting syringe. And now, about 82% of Massachusetts adults have received at least one shot. In fact, all of the New England states have passed Biden's 70% goal. Given that success, Massachusetts is closing big vaccination sites like this one at the Heinz Convention Center in Boston. Staff roll pallets of unused alcohol swabs, bandages, and masks onto loading docks. Rodrigo Martinez is with the company that ran four of the mass sites.
As these sites sort of come to their mission completed, time to close, we need to keep pushing harder into the neighborhoods, into those locations that really need it.
Locations where many of the still unvaccinated live. The state is targeting 20 lower-income communities with high COVID numbers and low vaccination rates, like Brockton. It's a diverse city with lots of essential workers who have suffered during the pandemic.
Bienvenue! Welcome!
Isabel Lopez, a vaccine ambassador, says hello to just about everyone who stops by a park in Brockton. A city event is offering free food, music, legal immigration advice, help signing up for health insurance, and vaccines.
We are here bringing the communities together to make this a fun day and also a creative way to get people vaccinated.
A big yellow touring bus converted to a mobile vaccination clinic idles in the parking lot. Lopez just scored a big win, persuading five members of the same household to board the bus, including Lennon Gomez. Gomez said he had doubts, but a nurse explained the vaccine would help protect children in his home.
If I'm not fully protected, who will take care of the little ones? That's what opened my mind to get vaccinated.
After Gomez gets his second shot, he can enter a state lottery for five $1 million jackpots. That's the latest in a series of raffles, prizes, and gift cards Massachusetts is using to entice hesitant residents to roll up their sleeves. My colleague Blake Farmer joins us from Nashville. Hey, Blake, any big vaccine prizes in Tennessee?
Hey, Martha. No vaccine lottery here in Tennessee or other southern states. And these are states that have the country's lowest vaccination rates. In fact, if you look at certain rural pockets, they're nowhere near the 70% goal. Some counties still have 70% of residents unvaccinated.
Wait, I had two vials in there.
In the town of Linden, Tennessee, nurse Kirstie Allen cracks open the vaccine fridge at the federally subsidized clinic. She says they're down to offering doses one day a week, usually less than 10.
First couple of weeks we had people booked, and then after that we had people start no-showing, and we had a waiting list. People on the waiting list didn't want to come. It's kind of gradually just gotten worse.
There's just a lot of vague skepticism, and Alan can sympathize. She's giving COVID shots, but she's not getting one herself. She says she's waiting for more research to see how everyone does over time.
Like, I'm one of those people who are unsure at the moment about getting it.
This wait-and-see attitude is especially common among white, rural conservatives in the South. But some holdouts are done waiting. 57-year-old Laurel Grant was worried about side effects.
But everybody I know has done real good. You know, just maybe a little fever or a little tiredness.
So she finally got her shot in June. It helped that the truck stop where she works offered a $75 bonus.
There's a bee down there at work that's like, oh, I'm not going to get it. And I'm like, yes, you are. You got to go, like it or not.
Converts like Grant are being seen as the best kind of evangelist for this next phase of vaccinating latecomers. Tennessee's health department has started putting them in video testimonials to release online. But those marketing efforts are annoying some Republican state lawmakers. They're convinced the state's actually trying too hard. A recent hearing at the state legislature included threats of disbanding Tennessee's health department. State Representative Iris Rutter, among others, held up printouts of social media ads featuring kids smiling with Band-Aids on their shoulders.
It's not your business to target children. It's your business to inform the parent that their child is eligible for the vaccination.
The state's health commissioner, Dr. Lisa Piercy, says she's not backing off on outreach. But she also doesn't think the situation is as dire as the low vaccination rates suggest. Tennessee had a huge surge of COVID during the winter. Piercy says that left at least 1 in 8 residents with some level of natural immunity. She says they're partially compensating for low vaccination rates.
I want everybody who wants a vaccine to get it. But what I really want at the end of the day is this pandemic to go away. And we're pretty close to getting there.
But the outlook is less rosy in neighboring Arkansas. The state escaped the worst of the winter outbreaks. Now it's trying to stop flare-ups caused by the more contagious Delta variant. Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson says if nothing else will inspire Southerners to get vaccinated, perhaps reality will. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
And I'm Martha Biebinger in Boston.
That story was produced in partnership with Nashville Public Radio, WBUR, and Kaiser Health News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of Align Probiotic, a daily supplement to support digestive health, containing a probiotic strain developed by gastroenterologists with 20 years of research. More at AlignProbiotics.com. And from Capital One, with the Saver Card, for various uses from dining and entertainment to streaming and grocery stores. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
This is NPR News.
For more than a year, the jazz world has been missing its lifeblood, live improvised music, but not for much longer.
I think there will come a time where we all will be jammed up in the club again. There will be plenty of hand sanitizer handy.
I'm Elsa Chang. The return of jazz this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered. It runs from 4 to 6:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
It's Morning Edition on WPR. Coming up in our newscast, a look at how much that summer cookout might be costing you, what an annual survey of grocery store prices says, and more Wisconsin news after this update from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. U.S. forces have pulled out of the last major military installation in Afghanistan. American troops left Bagram Air Force Base ahead of a September 11th deadline set by President Biden for a complete withdrawal from the country. NPR's Dia Hadid reports that's giving momentum to the Taliban, which have steadily been gaining ground.
The Taliban are moving faster than anybody really expected. Since May, they've captured about a quarter of the country. They now hold one of the largest dams. They're nearly at Afghanistan's tiny border with China. They hold one border crossing. They're trying to seize more. And the insurgents share videos of themselves seizing Afghan army equipment abandoned by fleeing forces.
NPR's Dia Hadid reporting. At least four people are dead after a massive landslide in Japan. 80 people are missing. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports the country was hit by heavy rains over the weekend.
1,500 police, firefighters, and soldiers are combing through mud and debris in the seaside resort town of Atami, some 60 miles southwest of Tokyo. A wall of mud and debris came crashing down the mountain and through the town mid-Saturday morning after heavy rains. 147 people were initially reported missing, but 67 of them had moved away or were not at home at the time of the disaster.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn reporting. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. Many Wisconsinites will pay more for their summer cookouts this year thanks to higher meat prices. That's according to an annual survey of grocery store prices. Hope Kerwin has more.
The Wisconsin Farm Bureau's Market Basket Survey found a summer picnic for 10 people costs just over $60. That's almost $4 more than when the same survey was done in 2019. The items with the largest increase in price were meats. Pork spare ribs cost almost 18% more than the previous survey, and the price for ground beef was up 9%. Cassie Sonnentag from the Farm Bureau says one positive that came out of the pandemic is that more of what consumers are spending on food will make it back to farmers, thanks to increased eating at home.
You're eliminating the cost of advertising. You're eliminating that cost of hosting or opening a restaurant. So there's definitely a higher share that goes back to the farmer when we're eating here at home.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture found grocery store sales were up 25% last year. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A recent report from the Thomas B. Fordham Institute says Wisconsin's state standards for teaching civics and U.S. history are overly broad and vague. It gave Wisconsin Fs for its standards in both. The conservative-leaning research organization looked at civics and history standards in response to growing political polarization and fights over history at state and district levels. To Beloit history teacher Matt Flynn, though, the situation within classrooms is more optimistic.
Students in general are much more engaged with what's going on, you know, because of social media. And then they at least have that baseline tweet to start the conversation. And then, you know, it's our job as teachers to, you know, expand on that and give them a little more context.
Flynn says the standards let him set up classes that help students think critically and stay engaged. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has issued an air quality advisory for ozone, in effect until 11 o'clock tonight, for all the Wisconsin counties bordering Lake Michigan. The air quality index is expected to reach the unhealthy for sensitive groups level. Sensitive groups, including children, elderly people, individuals with respiratory and cardiac problems, should avoid extended outdoor exposure. In the weather forecast today, mostly sunny skies across Wisconsin. There's a chance of afternoon thunderstorms for the northeastern, central, and southern parts of the state. Highs from the upper 80s to low 90s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from DuckDuckGo, a privacy company committed to making privacy online simple. Used by tens of millions, they offer private search and tracker blocking with one download. DuckDuckGo, privacy simplified. And from C3 AI. C3 AI software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable problems. C3 AI. This is Enterprise AI.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
I'm Noel King.
And I'm Rachel Martin. The Supreme Court has dealt a blow to the Voting Rights Act. This is a landmark law from the civil rights movement. And this has turned up the pressure on President Biden to step in. This week, he is expected to lay out his case for what needs to happen. NPR's Ayesha Rascoe joins us now to talk about the limited options for the White House. Ayesha, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
The Democrats brought up this broad voting rights bill in the Senate a few weeks ago, and it failed. Now that the Supreme Court has weighed in and reaffirmed states' rights over elections, what can the president do?
For big sweeping changes, that will take Congress. There are two voting rights bills stalled right now. One is more narrow in scope. It's called the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. And the other is the one that you mentioned that failed in the Senate. That's very broad. It's the For the People Act. The problem for both bills is that there is a 60-vote threshold in the Senate, and neither of them can clear that right now. I talked about that with Cedric Richmond, a senior White House advisor, and he said that the White House views this moment as just the beginning of the fight. He said the president is going to be using his bully pulpit and the power of the White House to try to bring civil rights groups, private companies, and activists together to bring more attention to this issue. Here's more of what he said.
We're going to fight in the courts. We're going to fight in the streets. We're going to fight, you know, for fair voting. We're going to do that. But at the same time, we want our groups and community leaders to also take the belt and suspenders approach of educating people on how to deal with these new laws. What do they mean? How do I still vote meaningfully?
But when it comes down to it, outside of influencing the public, there's not much they could do that would really have a major impact.
Can you say more about the kinds of pressure the White House is getting from civil rights groups?
Activists absolutely do not want this issue to fall by the wayside. They are pleased that Vice President Harris has been made the point person on this issue, but they want to make sure that it's a top priority. I talked to Jamal Watkins of the NAACP, one of the groups that has been in talks with the White House. Watkins says he believes that Biden should use his authority to keep in place some of the safety measures from the last election to protect voters who are not vaccinated and may not be vaccinated by next year. He also said that the White House could try to push the U.S. Postal Service to make it easier to vote by mail.
The Postal Service can be a vessel, if you will, to eliminate barriers by ensuring ballot tracking, ballots actually being prioritized at the highest level, and other improvements around scanning of identification cards.
But ultimately, Watkins and other people that I talked to said Biden is limited in what he can do unless he pushes for changes to the filibuster.
Ah, so let's talk about that. I mean, just a reminder, the filibuster is the Senate rule that requires 60 votes to advance a bill like this one. Are there any new signs that Biden is ready to go all in on reforming it?
Well, he's certainly getting a lot of pressure to do something. The protections that civil rights groups really want can only come through Congress, and they don't want the filibuster to stand in the way. Wade Henderson is with the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. He said the status quo is unacceptable.
We know that without congressional action, there is not nearly the scope of enforcement initiatives available to the president that we think are necessary. For that reason, both bills must be passed in some form.
But it doesn't look like the White House is at the point of doing a full court press on this, on the filibuster. When I talked to Cedric Richmond, he said the White House still wants to give lawmakers a chance to reach a bipartisan deal.
NPR's Ayesha Rascoe. Ayesha, thank you.
Thank you.
It's called Summer Camp for Billionaires. This week, top executives at the biggest and most influential companies in tech and media, including Apple, Facebook, and Netflix, gather in Sun Valley, Idaho, to hike and golf and to make deals. NPR's David Guerra introduces us to the private investment bank that brings them together.
On the first day of this week-long gathering, around 90 private jets will land at the small airport near this tiny mountain town. Then a who's who of media moguls and tech titans will take over the Sun Valley Resort. In years past, their arrival has gotten breathless play-by-play treatment on CNBC.
Well, we're already seeing some of the biggest names arrive.
Tim Cook usually shows up, and so does Mark Zuckerberg. Jeff Bezos is a regular, and so is Warren Buffett and Oprah. Well, this week, it's likely the aggregate wealth of the men and women staying in Sun Valley will be more than $1 trillion.
It really is elitism on full display.
Media analyst Colin Gillis is with the firm Chatham Road Partners.
But actually, it's a very private event, so I shouldn't say full display.
The Allen & Company Sun Valley Conference is a spectacle. The dress code is casual and outdoorsy, and that seems compulsory. In years past, Patagonia fleece vests have been standard issue.
I tend to watch, you know, the reports that come out of this conference, you know, with a bowl of popcorn, right?
It's entertaining, Gillis says. But each photo of participants mingling in the mountain air could be a clue about what could be the next big deal in media and tech. Stephen Davidoff Solomon runs the Berkeley Center for Law and Business.
They've organized the biggest matchmaking service for media companies.
And that's the reason why it's one of the most coveted invitations in business from a bank a lot of people haven't heard of. Allen & Co. avoids publicity, and the firm doesn't have a website. It didn't respond for NPR's request for an interview. It's been around since 1922, and the bank has been run by the same family for three generations. And in all that time, it's built some deep personal relationships. Donna Histrich teaches finance at Columbia Business School.
You know, at the end of the day, I think what a lot of people don't necessarily completely appreciate is that this business is all about people, right?
And she says that personal touch has gotten harder to come by at banks that are publicly traded and therefore beholden to investors. Its focus on relationships also extends to how and whom it hires. Allen & Co. brings on board people who are well-connected, including prominent former members of Congress and George Tenet, who ran the CIA. Its bankers seem content to keep a low profile. That's an Allen & Co. trademark. And the firm seems to have no problem poaching from its bigger rivals, according to Drew Pascarella, an associate dean at Cornell University's business school.
Folks that are at the prime of their career, all the relationships are already built.
And those relationships seem to pay off. Allen & Co. advised Facebook and Google on their multi-billion dollar IPOs. And it's been reported Amazon's founder, Jeff Bezos, decided to buy the Washington Post in Sun Valley. The goal, Pascarella says, is for lucrative deals to emerge eventually.
And, you know, it culminates in a large fee when the time is right.
That's the model on which Allen & Co.'s built its business, and it continues to operate. So the next time there's a merger or acquisition in media or tech, there's a good chance it may have been hatched at a resort in central Idaho. David Gura, NPR News.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, the Biden administration walks a fine line. It's trying to tackle an increase in violent crime while also calling for accountability for racism and brutality in policing. To listen, ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. This is NPR News.
Morning Edition on WPR. And coming up in 9 minutes, Rachel Martin speaks with author Ocean Vuong about books that depict the immigrant experience. Stay tuned.
The generosity of more than 50,000 members and 600 business sponsors ensures that the news, conversations, music, and companionship that you rely on are here on Wisconsin Public Radio whenever you need them. Thank you for your support. You keep our entire community informed and connected.
Support for WPR comes from Glass Nickel Pizza, 23 years of pizzas made from scratch. Now offering non-contact delivery and curbside pickup in 9 locations in Wisconsin. Menu and ordering at glassnickelpizza.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Kenosha Area Chamber of Commerce is hosting their Scholarship Golf Classic Monday, August 30th at the Kenosha Country Club. All proceeds will be used to award college scholarships to graduating seniors. Visit KenoshaAreaChamber.com.
Wisconsin Public Radio, and here are some of the day's stories. Cyprus authorities say a deadly brush fire that claimed 4 lives and has been described as the most destructive blaze in the Republic's 61-year history is now fully under control. Cyprus's forestry department said more than 600 people managed to contain the blaze early this morning after it scorched more than 21 square miles, forcing the evacuation of 9 villages and burning down homes, businesses, orchards, and forest. Oregon's governor says a Pacific Northwest heat wave has killed at least 95 people in that state alone. Democratic Governor Kate Brown said Sunday on CBS's Face the Nation that government officials warned people about the heat, dispersed water to vulnerable people, and set up cooling stations. Even so, Brown calls the death toll, quote, absolutely unacceptable. Hundreds are believed to have died from the heat over the past week in the U.S. Northwest and southwestern Canada. Record temperatures included 116 degrees in Portland and 108 in Seattle. The hot weather is headed east. You're listening to news from Wisconsin Public Radio. There's more online at WPR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from UKG. HR and workforce management solutions designed to make employees happy. When employees feel supported, businesses become more than a place of work. They become a work of art. UKG, our purpose is people. From the estate of Samir Naguib, whose bequest helps ensure access for all, to quality public radio reporting and stories that encourage lifelong learning. And from the William T. Grant Foundation at wtgrantfoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Noelle King. Good morning. Indonesia's president just announced some new measures to fight the spread of the coronavirus there. Indonesia is leading Southeast Asia in both infections and deaths. Here's Michael Sullivan.
President Joko Widodo says the new measures mean shopping malls, schools, and mosques are all closed for the next 2 weeks. In-restaurant dining is also banned, and non-essential employees are to work from home. But the new restrictions only apply to parts of the main island Java and the resort island of Bali. And critics say they fall far short of what's needed.
I think it's like, you know, a cosmetic policy, you know, not the most strongest that can stop the transmission.
Epidemiologist Pandu Riono of the University of Indonesia says that's especially true now that the highly contagious Delta variant has arrived as well.
They said, okay, don't panic. It's become, you know, everybody is already panicked.
With reason. Indonesia has reported new daily records for weeks now. Yesterday, it recorded the highest number of deaths since the pandemic began, over 550 and more than 27,000 new infections. Epidemiologist Diki Budiman has advised previous Indonesian governments.
Currently, almost all hospitals in Java Island already have 98% bed occupancy. And some of them already closed the hospital to receive or in receiving the COVID-19 patient.
Public health expert and COVID data analyst Irma Hidayana also helps patients find beds. On Tuesday, she worked to find one for a man whose oxygen levels were plummeting. She tried several hospitals in the capital, Jakarta, with no luck, and she says the nurse at the last one was blunt.
You need to know that we have no wheelchair, we have no bed, and we have no oxygen.
It's the same, Irma Hidayana says, almost everywhere.
June 14 till June 30, we lost 11 people. They died before they got medical help from the hospital.
Diki Budiman warns it's going to get much, much worse in the next month. The new restrictions, too little, too late, especially when they apply to just over half the population.
So at least end of July until mid of August, we still have around 300,000 to 500,000 cases a day. And the death case will be around 2,000 to 3,000 a day.
A half a million cases a day, he says, in a country where the health system has all but collapsed, with a government, critics say, that's still prioritizing the economy over the health of its people, one that's recently lost dozens of doctors and nurses to COVID, even after they were fully vaccinated with the Chinese Sinovac vaccine.
Not okay, and this is worrying me, because then we have an issue of about the effectiveness of Sinovac in the real world against Delta variant. So that's a very high concern.
A Delta variant that now has the Indonesian government scrambling, with testing, contact tracing, and vaccinations limited. And without a total lockdown, many experts now worry Indonesia could become the next India. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai, Thailand.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and about 10 minutes before 9 now. Coming up, we'll have classical music with your host, Stephanie Elkins. Stay with us.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. Honor a life well lived with a gift of a service for burial or cremation with a professional, friendly, and compassionate staff. Serving the community for 90 years, Piasecki Funeral Home.
Health and healing in our communities. Dial 211 to speak to a counselor or visit projectrecoverywi.org.
Morning Edition on WPR. In sports, the Pittsburgh Pirates ended Milwaukee's 11-game winning streak with a 2-0 victory over the Brewers yesterday. Milwaukee starts a series against the Mets tonight. In weather today, mostly sunny skies across Wisconsin. There's a chance of afternoon thunderstorms for the northeastern, central, and southern parts of the state. Highs from the upper 80s to the low 90s. On Tuesday, mostly sunny in the south with a chance of afternoon thunderstorms. Rain is likely for the rest of the state. It could be heavy at times, and northwestern Wisconsin could see a few inches of it. Highs ranging from the mid-60s near Lake Superior to the upper 80s in the south.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
I'm Leila Falden.
And I'm Rachel Martin. What does it mean to live between cultures, languages, and genders? It's something Vietnamese-American author Ocean Vuong knows well. In his novel, On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous, he explores colonial history and his own personal experiences to tell a coming-of-age story. NPR asked him for his book recommendations that also draw on the immigrant experience. Ocean Vuong joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Rachel. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with the poetry collection that you have selected for us. It's called Slow Lightning by Eduardo Corral. Tell us about the author and what draws you to him.
Oh, when I think of Eduardo's work, I think he's the quintessential poet's poet. But that doesn't mean his work is obscure. This book particularly is haunted by the immigrant experience on the border. Corral comes from parents who are Mexican immigrants, and there's a sensibility of what is an American body that comes through migration and great loss. This book is filled with mourning and grief. It's an elegy to the lives lost crossing the border. The tragedy of immigration to America is, in a sense, the tragedy of human life for the dream. So Corral is a writer that cares both for the poetic line, but also for the bodies that he writes about, for family, legacy, culture, and what it means to be American. I go to this book again and again, and to me, it's a masterpiece.
There is no translation of this, and that's intentional, right?
Yeah. The Spanish here has no glossary. It has no endnote. It exists on the same footing as the English words, right? In a sense, it is an enactment of the sensation of walking through America.
You've also brought us a novel by a Taiwanese writer that I understand is semi-autobiographical, told in the form of letters. The book is called Last Words from Montmartre.
Yeah, so this might sound familiar to my own book. I'm truly inspired by Qiu Mujan. She's a Taiwanese immigrant to Paris. And we often don't think of the immigrant having, or the immigrant story, having a sex life, a love life, a life of depression and deep existential angst. And Mujan really positions in immigrant narrative, in existential wonder. And I think this is one of the most powerful testaments of rewriting or repositioning what immigration is on a global scale. And it positions the immigrant in the trajectory of the artist. Because I think immigration demands a great amount of innovation and creativity. Nobody really survives the process of immigrating to a new country, to America, no less, which is so rich and complex, without being creative. So I love this book because it kind of pushes creativity and innovation at the center, that immigrants are not just victims who are trying to get by. They are active agents in their own life.
I love that idea of the migration experience, the immigrant experience, demanding a certain level of creativity. I think that's going to stick with me for a while. You are crisscrossing the world with these selections. You've got an autobiographical novel by V.S. Naipaul. It's called The Enigma of Arrival. What is this about?
Oh my goodness. This is, to me, it's like the Bible of the immigrant writer. And it's the testament of Naipaul coming from a British colonial territory of Trinidad and reading and being educated by European writers, reading about snow, yet never feeling it, never seeing it, reading it in Dickens and never seeing it until he arrives almost at age 20 in London and seeing snow for the first time. And in a sense, Naipaul is really interesting because he kind of mastered the British style, you know, high exposition, deep winding meditations, dialogue. And yet he is never truly fully comfortable in his works, in being a Londoner or a British writer. He's always feeling estranged. And this book, The Enigma of Arrival, named after a painting by Chirico, is exactly that. Is that the two words here, enigma and arrival, never leave Naipaul as a writer. The estrangement of being in a new world and yet forever arriving, never truly having arrived. The immigrant process is one that is ongoing and filled with wonder, curiosity, and a sense of loneliness.
You have one more for us, a French novel.
Yes. It's very global here, right? One of my goals was to kind of decenter America as the site of immigration. And we realized that immigration is a species-wide legacy. Everyone who's been human from time immemorial has had to make the decision about how to move and escape and make new roots. Dorat's The Lover is a perennial classic for me in this theme and others. Because this is a very unique situation of a failed colonial project. Marguerite Duras arrives in Vietnam through her family, and she's born in Vietnam, and she starts to write out of poverty. You know, the French colonial project fails in Vietnam, and Duras, which is supposed to be a part of this new settlement in what is then French Indochina, suddenly finds herself in abject poverty in the countryside of Vietnam, and she writes out of this position. And I think her immigration, her family's immigration, begins with the failure of a colonial project. And then she writes out of a girlhood. What is it like to write in the shadow of your own empire? What is it like to have privileges and yet still be part of a declining empirical force? It's absolutely unique. You'll probably never see a text like this again. And I think I'm so grateful that Duras was able to write out of this position so that we have this legacy marked and tracked.
Ocean Vuong, his 2019 novel, On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, is newly out in paperback. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rachel. It's a deep pleasure.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Noelle King.
And I'm Melissa Ingalls. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Every hour, we'll have news updates from NPR and WPR for you, and you can always find more news on our website at WPR.org. It's a minute before 9.
Support for WPR comes from Summit Players Theater, presenting family-friendly performances of Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale, plus educational workshops this week in the Ashland and Superior areas. SummitPlayersTheater.com.
Support comes from Kenosha County ADRC. Kenosha County Western Transit now offers Saturday and Sunday demand service from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Fares are $5 one way for the general public and $3 for older adults or persons with disabilities. For reservations, call 888-203-3498.